Hi, I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yes. This is episode number 98. We're getting close to 100. We're going to talk about a Christmas movie called It's a Wonderful Life, directed by Frank Capra.
Such a classic.
It is a classic film. Yes. One of my favorite movies of all time. It just gets me. I really like this movie.
Yes, rewatching it, I practically had it memorized anyway, because at one point when it was on TV all the time, I was watching it all the time. But as I watched it, I thought, yeah, this movie ends at Christmas, but it has something to say about your whole life. It really is a top 10 movie.
Right. Yep, it definitely is.
Mm-hmm.
So it was directed by Frank Capra, who was born in 1897, died in 1991. Says he was an Italian-born American film director, producer, and writer. Francesco
immigrant?
Rosario Capra is his name.
Wow.
Says Sicily.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky us. He might have been making spaghetti westerns otherwise.
That's right.
Gosh.
So we are lucky. Says here Capra's family was Roman Catholic, as would be expected from Italy.
Right.
Fascinating. So one connection, a loose connection, connection to me. The first play I was ever in was You Can't Take It With You, which was a Frank Capra movie.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't write it, but he directed it. So,
an early one?
Yeah, well, 1938.
Okay.
I think it was in his prime years. The movie he did right after that was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Ah.
Yeah.
We could all stand a dose of that right now.
Right. And It's a Wonderful Life came out in 1946. So, fresh out of World War II and near the end of his career. He didn't do a lot of films after that. Yeah, he did. Let's see. So It's a Wonderful Life was in 1946, and there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 films between then and 1964.
Okay.
So almost 20 years, and he just made a few more after this. I guess he put everything into this one.
Well, the funny thing is, though, I can't remember if I've told this story, so just sit back, everyone, if you've heard it before. But I remember at one point in the 70s or something, Johnny Carson had Jimmy Stewart on, and he asked him, what was the favorite movie you ever made? And Jimmy Stewart said, well, it's a movie that didn't do very well, and I don't know why, and no one's ever heard of it, called It's a Wonderful Life. And Johnny Carson goes, what was it about? I mean, no one had ever heard of it. And he says, and so he kind of just briefly tells the plot about if you didn't ever exist, how would life have been different? And he goes, I always really thought that was such a great idea, and I was sorry it didn't do better. And then I, of course, took note because I love Jimmy Stewart like everyone did. And then just a few years later, I guess, suddenly it got discovered again, and it was out of copyright, so it was all over every TV station. And I was so thrilled because I got to see Jimmy Stewart's favorite movie. And I didn't realize at the time the deep attachment that Frank Capra, I guess, had to it when he was making it, from that quote that we were talking about before we started filming.
Yeah. Yeah, I can read that quote.
That would be great.
Yeah, it says, this is from an article I'll link to in the show notes, but it says here that Capra called It's a Wonderful Life the greatest film he had ever made. And then here's a quote from him. A film to tell the wary, the disheartened, and the disillusioned, the wino, the junkie, the prostitute, those behind prison walls and those behind iron curtains, that no man is a failure. To show those born slow of foot or slow of mind, those oldest sisters condemned to spinsterhood, and those oldest sons condemned to unschooled toil, that each man's life touches so many other lives, and that if he isn't around, it would leave an awful hole. And that's the quote. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm not sure, you know, when in his life he said that, but, you know, since that movie was late in his career, he did have the rest of his career to look back on when he made it. So,
yeah. And yeah. You kind of see, of course, those themes are the little man, the everyman can make a difference mm-hmm. through the, at least the better known movies that I've seen. And so if you're a really great artist, you keep coming back to the same themes because you're trying to express yourself on that in different ways. So I could see why he was looking at this as his great movie. I think I would have cut a little from the middle somewhere. It was, I was going, okay, I get it. You're attracted to each other. Oh, we don't need to watch
this. Yeah, among other things, this movie is a terrific romance, I thought. Mm-hmm. I just loved it. The telephone scene gets me every single time.
Oh my gosh.
That and I'm just like, man, I can feel that. That was
It's hotter
great.
In here.
Just fantastic.
And when you think about Donna Reed mm-hmm. and Jimmy Stewart, you don't think about sex symbols, at least, you know, and that scene they did together, there is just palpable sexual tension. You
can
just
gosh.
Cut it with a knife and oh my goodness, they did it so perfectly.
They really did. They really did. Yeah. And maybe the most unbelievable part of this movie is that they were in the same town for 4 years, this small town, you know, between when his little brother went off to college and came back, and they really, you know, didn't see each other that much, apparently, during that 4 years.
Well,
although
I thought
she went off. She went off, didn't she?
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
She'd just come back from school. Well,
that's
now,
right.
Do we need
that's
to even
right.
describe this movie at
I don't
all?
Even know if we need to bother. If you haven't seen this movie yet, go ahead and press stop and turn on any channel.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, because it's Christmas and you've been living in a cave somewhere,
that's right,
I guess.
That's right. Yeah, we should probably describe it. George Bailey is the son of a guy who owns a what's called a building and loan, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a business that does business with a lot of the, I would say, middle to lower class people.
Right.
Because there is a rival, and his name is Potter. And he is the rich guy in town. And he's building, you know, things to make money. He builds buildings and then tries to get people to rent them, charges them too much money. And, you know, they don't own anything. He's just basically trying to get what he can out of them.
Yeah.
So there's this competition set up, and really the building and loan is the last remaining thing that's not Potter owned.
Well, about halfway through the movie that happens. But yeah, George is just, he's a small town boy, and you see him growing up, and so you see his good deeds that mm-hmm. he did just as a court matter his life.
As a child, yeah.
Yeah, when he was a young boy and then growing up. And then you see him as a young man and he wants to go off and see the world. And this is a theme in his life. He wants to go off and see the world and become an architect and do great things and build buildings. And he is continually thwarted by events. And they always revolve around that dang building and loan that he can't get away from.
Right.
You know, his father has a stroke and Uncle Billy can't run it because Uncle Billy's pretty much a doddering guy that he's kind of, it's kind of a charity to let Uncle Billy work at the savings and loan, really. And then at the same time, he's very attracted to Donna Reed, who's, I can't remember her character, Mary. How could I forget? Mm-hmm. Name is Mary. And so there's a romance in there, and we're shown all this from the point of view. And I had forgotten this altogether. It starts off with, you know, two stars kind of talking to each other. Their heavenly bodies shown up in the sky, and George Bailey's hitting his most crucial moment tonight. So they call in Clarence,
mm-hmm.
who hasn't gotten his wings yet, and they're all Clarence. So we all have our problems, right? Even Joseph and whoever he's talking to, and then who are going to direct Clarence. So Clarence is seeing his life so that he can know how to help him. And at some point, Potter gets the upper hand. He tries and tries and tries to beat George because no one has beat him. And George manages, just through the depression, through everything, through giving all his savings, to hang on to that building and loan because it's the only place that gives the little guy hope.
Right.
He can have his own house and everything. And then the moment hits and he's so desperate that, oh man, was that not great the way Potter went, oh, you're worth more dead than alive, because his life insurance policy and just let that dangle.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's so desperate, he's thinking about killing himself, jumping off of a bridge, and instead Clarence does.
And yeah, he feels at that point he's given up so yeah. many things, and it's all falling apart, and he's just like, man, I don't know if I can go on.
Yeah, there's going to be public disgrace. His family is going to be dragged through the mud with him because of this scandal that's looming over lost money in the saving or building and loan.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't know what to do. And then at one point he says, oh, it'd be better if I was never born. And Clarence goes, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
You were never born. Let's see how everything's different.
Yep.
And everything's very different.
Back into town, into old Bedford Falls. And now Bedford Falls is Pottersville. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, I just took over.
No, it's perfect. Thank you.
But
but yeah, that's exactly what it's about, you know. But you know, of course, the key thing is George.
Yeah.
And that character, man, it really affects me. It's so well written and so well played.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that strikes me as the most important theme is the difference between, well, I can't say the most important theme because to me it has several themes. You know, I guess the most important theme is probably that your life has purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And like Frank Capra said in that quote, you know, you're telling everybody, you know, gosh, if you weren't here, you have no idea what it would be like if you weren't here. And your life has purpose. You're here for a reason. And so that would be the most thing. But the thing that I feel so much when I watch the movie is how George continually is making the plans.
Yeah.
And he constantly, I mean, with every fiber of his being, he just wants to do certain things. And he continually chooses the right thing, not the thing that he wants.
Yeah.
He chooses the right thing. And the right thing is always in service to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that that's so well done. Really great.
Yeah. I loved it. And, well, because that's the thing. It made me think of that saying that you've mentioned, and I really clung on to that. I love it, that vocation is the lack of obstacles, the absence of obstacles, meaning that, you know, you can keep trying and doing everything, but, you know, there's some things that just come easier. And for George, what you see is every time he was like, I'm going to be selfish, and it wasn't in a bad way. It was just, this is what he really wanted to do.
Yeah.
He said,
yeah.
I want to do something big and something important.
Mm-hmm.
And every time he was set off to do that, something came up. His father has a stroke. You know, that's the depression. There's a run on the bank. And he could have easily turned his back on all that. I mean, everybody kept going. You've stayed on. Now it's time for you to leave. Don't worry about it. Go off on your trip. Go on your honeymoon.
Mm, yeah.
You know, and they would have understood. And he couldn't let it go. And early on, there was something when he's in the pharmacy and he doesn't know what to do because Mr. Gower has accidentally put poison in the capsules, which I was like, oh, right. People make those capsules in these kind of old pharmacies.
Yeah.
And so he sees a sign that says, you know, something like, go ask Dad. And so he goes to his father, who isn't able to answer him because he's fighting with Mr. Potter. And so that's where you see how important this is and how George absorbs how important this is.
Mm-hmm.
Because his father makes that one speech about, yeah, you're the only one I'm not going to let get his mitts into the little guy in town. But there's later a picture of his father. And underneath it, it says something like the only thing you gain is what you don't take with you when you leave, ultimately.
Yeah.
And so that was that idea that you give everything away and you give yourself away, which is what his father did. And I thought it was really interesting to see those little reminders of his father, because it was his father's example that taught him and that led him, even though you don't see his father very much.
Yeah, and his father was not a rich man. Mm-mm. He was doing fine. You know, when we see him, you know, George had been waiting until his little brother graduated high school. And his little brother was going to take over the business or help right. his dad while he went off, George went off to do his thing, you know, go be an architect.
College.
And, you know, he talks to his father, and his father says, or he says, "Man, you look tired." You know, and his father says, "Yeah, well, I've been fighting Potter today." And later that night, you know, he has a stroke. Mm-hmm. But so he watched his father give everything, and he watched his father be, you know, his father was appreciated. But at the same time, you know, George felt like, you know, he had to love all these people, even though, well, I mean, he just did. He made the decision to help these people rather than do this. And he loved the fact that he was watching people, like, pay for their own house and start to have a successful life and be happy. He loved that. But constantly felt, well, I'm not happy myself. Right?
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's really brought out in this. I mean, there's never a scene where he's feeling that satisfaction and not also seeing the cost of it. Like, mm-hmm. I love when the Martini family is going to move into their new house and their goat. And mm-hmm. it looked like about 10 little kids and everything. And so they're moving the family over, and it's a great celebration. And then here comes Sam Wainwright, the classmate who has become very rich.
Right.
And he's got a wonderful car, and he's just headed down to Florida for vacation. Why don't you guys come with us? Well, no, we can't go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are things that are more rewarding. He's just helped the Martinis later on. I can't remember if that's that night when he finds out he's going to be a father or very soon after that, but he's regretting. He looks at their car and he looks at his beat up car.
Yeah.
He wishes he could give his wife a nice house. And jewels,
that's one of those moments where you realize how perfect Mary and him together are.
Yeah.
Because Mary steps up and she starts the toast.
Yeah.
She says something about salt for, I can't remember what the exact toast was, but she took over. And then about, you know, at the third item in the list of this toast is when he said, you know what, this is okay. And then, continues in there and shares in the joy, but yet you can still feel that he's like, man, did I make the right choice? Did I make the right choice for my family?
Yeah.
So he's in doubt all the time.
And it is a celebration of marriage too.
It really is, because they really are just perfect for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they're definitely a team. She helps him and vice versa. It's great.
Oh, yeah.
It really is a celebration of marriage.
Yeah, because this isn't one of these things where, even though it was done in 1946, and she's a fairly traditional feminine figure in that, you know, she doesn't say, "Hey, George, let's go out on a date," but she's throwing the hints out, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, you know, she's had the war comes, and they're like, "Well, Mary had two more children, but she still ran the USO. You know, mm-hmm. she was doing plenty of stuff. She redid their whole house herself, it looked like, pretty much. They're living in a huge rundown mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful
home. Even on that the run on the bank, you know. They're both headed out to go on their honeymoon. They've got a handful of money that has been gifted to them. And she's the one who comes in the bank and says, "Here's some money."
Yeah.
And not only that, but while he was doing that, she was setting up the house. I mean, that night, you know, so that they could have whatever.
For their honeymoon.
A tiny bit of a honeymoon, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they really are a wonderful team together.
They really are.
By the way, I just want to mention, speaking of the honeymoon, because one of my favorite moments is Bert and Ernie singing, "I love you truly, truly dear."
That's right. That's right.
And you can see the silhouettes of them kissing inside. I'm like, wow, that's such a great scene. Mm. And I guess you know already that Bert and Ernie on Sesame Street were named for that Bert and Ernie.
Yes, I do. That's yeah, sweet.
That's, I just love that. I just
love
had
that
to
too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they're so great together.
Which is wonderful, thinking that maybe, you know, they were named that back when the movie wasn't super popular, right?
Yeah, I guess so. You're right.
That is really cool. Whoever did that, kudos. That's neat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
That's really good.
It really is good.
I would like to talk about Mr. Potter and how many ways we can see the devil tempting us when we're, you know, I mean, he's pure evil. And I kind of love, well, actually not kind of, I absolutely love that he doesn't have a backstory. We don't know about anything that happened to him that made him awful. He's just awful.
You know what? And that is, you know, awful. When you think about it, that is refreshing. And not only that, but he didn't get his at the end. And he didn't have the moment of redemption where, you know, he's like, well, you're right. I was terrible. Here's a whole bunch of money.
Nope.
Or some feel-good ending where, you know what I mean? He got away scot-free as far as we know.
Oh, yeah.
And isn't that interesting?
Yeah. He kept the $8,000, didn't have to give it back
because
they didn't know what happened to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. He stole it.
And in that sense, he is a truly diabolical figure.
Yeah.
If you're going to just, as Catholics watching this movie, I looked at that and I went, wow, he tries force. He tries threats. He gets in there and starts maneuvering the board members around, pushing them around and using influence. And then when that doesn't work, he is luring with attractive things like, hey, George, come and work for me. You don't have to give up your building and loan, but wouldn't you like to make $20,000 a year and your wife could have a nice house and all this? And, you know, it's so attractive that he goes right up to the point of shaking his hand and then he realizes what he's doing.
Yeah, I love that George thought about it. I love that he was taken by it and was like, you know, this sounds good to me.
Yeah, because he's a human being.
Yeah.
He was tempted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that was the other thing I was thinking of that I forgot to mention before is I think of this movie and I think of George as being, oh, he's a great guy. But what I realized watching it this time, not only could he be tempted like that, but he was more volatile than I remembered. He could have a bad mood and be a jerk.
Yeah.
Like when he goes over to Mary's, he winds up there despite everything. He doesn't want to be there and he's just awful to her, even though she's pretty excited to see him. Or, you know, different times when he's in a bad mood and he just lets it show. You know, he's not throwing things, but you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, I didn't really think of what a complete human being he is.
You know, and it is complete. You know, that's where I was kind of trying to head. I mean, not because it's just not fully formed in my thoughts, but, you know, the thoughts where you have this thing that you want more than what you have all the time has got to affect your mood negatively. You know, he wasn't accepting his lot or accepting his vocation or his role or whatever you want to call it. He was fighting against it the entire time.
Well, and toward the end of the, before he has the big crisis point at the moment of death and runs into Clarence, he actually, you get the feeling before Uncle Billy loses that money, he actually was okay. They were scraping by and he'd kind of forgotten about all that other stuff, but you're right. It's always there underneath waiting to pop up, you know, so that when that $20,000 is offered, a year is offered, he, ooh.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. And that's why I think he could be pretty irritable. Because always there. It's always there under the surface. He is a good guy, but he's being poked constantly. And part of it is his own doing by not living right now. And, you know what I'm saying? He's constantly looking somewhere else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could quote Yoda. Never your mind on where you are. Yes. Speaking of another Muppet reference.
And Star Wars. So.
And Star Wars, right.
Yeah.
So back to Darth Vader. Oh, and Potter. I meant Potter.
Yes. Darth Vader and Luke.
Right. Right. So you were talking about Potter and how he was tempting in so many different ways.
Yeah, I just looked at him and said he is pure evil. There is nothing redemptive about him. And he I don't know what Frank Capra had in mind, but watching it from a Catholic viewpoint, I just went, wow, isn't that just like the devil? You know, it doesn't mean we can't bother ourselves just like George does, you know, by not letting that dream go, by being frustrated over things. But at the same time, you've got this constant pushing of, I know what your sore points are, because when he says, I'll offer you this salary, because let's face it, here's what you're like. And I mean, he pegs him to a T. He knows what he's like.
Yeah.
He knows he's frustrated and he wanted to travel. And I just looked at that and went, oh my gosh, he's the devil right here.
Exactly. You're so right. You're so right about that. Yeah. And then that makes sense with how he's got no beginning and no end. Maybe that's a statement that this is just how it is. There's going to be people like this. We don't, you know, bad people get away with doing bad things all the time. You know, as far as we know in life, you know, we see them do things without consequences, but we know that there are consequences.
Yes, but not that they'll face maybe when we even in our lifetime.
Exactly. So that is interesting to do something so different like that. You know, let's not close his story. I mean, it was open at the beginning and it was open at the end.
Yeah, because you almost want that satisfaction of he's got to give that money back.
Yeah, he's got to give the money back, end up in jail, or have some kind of a Scrooge moment.
Yeah,
or he discovers what Christmas really is or something like that.
Yeah, the town turning on him.
He's just evil.
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly. And the only satisfaction is that he doesn't win ever because it's not Pottersville.
Yeah.
We see what happens when he wins, and it's not pretty.
Hmm.
Everybody is their worst character.
Yeah, their worst selves.
I mean, when you see Donna Reed as the librarian, since she never got married, and he's trying to talk to her. Now, granted, he's a little insane at that point, but and it's, of course, would be scary. But there was no reason for her to react as violently as she did to that, in my opinion.
Mm.
Now, maybe at that time that would have affected somebody differently, but she was safe. She's with these two women. People are grabbing him. The police have him, and she faints.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah, she's not just an old maid. She's not right either. She's repressed or hysterical or something else. You know, she's not her full self either.
Yep.
Like the mother when he goes to the boarding house. And she's not nice, kindly mother. She's, you know, got a bad attitude and she's tired looking and she's kind of frowsy.
Yeah, and I feel was like assuming
that's a clean boarding house.
Yeah, I felt like you know, people get that way living like they're living for so long. I mean, who knows what kind of characters that she was having to put up with all the time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But it's that because he wasn't there, it affected everybody in terms of you couldn't be your full self because you didn't have all the good stuff you could have had, or you know, the influences, even though you know, people are having to deal with George and his bad moods or anything. That also affects us in terms of how do we, like, you know, Mary. Like you said, he and Mary were so good together. Well, one of the reasons Mary was so good together, she had to be patient and exert herself to help her husband.
Yeah.
That helps her be her best self, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. This movie does have everything.
It's, you bet.
Oh, my gosh. I don't want to change my desert island list, but it could happen.
Oh, shoot.
Although I still maintain my favorite Christmas movie is a different one, and we'll watch it next year.
Okay. Well, I've got to hear by the end of this podcast, I need to know what that is.
Okay. Christmas Carol starring Alastair Sim.
Really?
I think it might be made in the 1950s.
I'll be darned.
Yes.
Okay.
Black and white, and it is the most amazing version ever of this movie.
Okay.
Better even than the Muppets Christmas Carol.
Impossible! No. With Alastair who?
Sim.
Alastair Sim, okay.
Uh-huh.
Every probably 3 years, 2 years or something, I read The Christmas Carol. I haven't read it this year, but I love that book. I absolutely love it.
I know. And Tim Curry reads, I think we talked about this last year, but Tim Curry reads a fantastic version of it.
Yeah.
that's unabridged.
Neat.
I know Patrick Stewart does a wonderful abridged version, but I have to have every one of Dickens' words in there.
Interesting. So yeah, as a Catholic, you know, I found something interesting about Frank Capra as a Catholic. It was it's also in the Crisis magazine, that article that I quoted earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It says here that Capra initially rejected his religious heritage. He said, but he gradually grew into it. He wrote that in his early childhood, he was a Christmas Catholic.
Mm.
But by the mid-1930s, the astonishing success of a movie called It Happened One Night triggered an artistic crisis, which resulted in a conversion experience not unlike the one faced by many of his characters.
Really?
It was the scolding given him by an anonymous man that pushed him into action. The talents you have, Mr. Capra, are not your own, not self-acquired. God gave you these talents. They are his gifts to you to use for his purpose. And when you don't use the gifts God blessed you with, you're an offense to God and to humanity.
Wow. Well,
Capra later developed this theme in It's a Wonderful Life, says this article.
Wow. I'm going to have to read that article.
Yeah. So that's an interesting way to look at that, too. You know, is this a, you know, a parable of the talents kind of a thing where... you know, clearly he knew how to run the savings and loan. He knew how to, he was very successful when he was doing it.
Well, no, I don't know if I'd say that, but he could keep it going.
Yeah, he could keep it going, but it, to him, it wasn't a hugely difficult thing.
Yeah.
It was something that came naturally to him, I think.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point.
And then, he wanted to be an architect, though. It's like, this is what I want to be, but this is what I'm good at.
Yeah.
But yeah, he wasn't getting rich, but he was keeping that thing afloat, which probably took anybody skills. It would have taken a lot of skills mm-hmm. to do it. I did get the feeling that not anybody would have been able to do that, not even his little brother.
No, and his father said that. His
right.
father said, oh, he's all right. He'll do okay, but he's not like you. You've got a real feel for it.
Right. So, so it was natural to Stewart.
Well, and it makes me think again of what, when you talk about Frank Capra and what that person scolded him with, and I'm thinking, and he also, though, did kind of what I guess George did, which was George wasn't just lending the money out. George was investing himself in the people. I mean, he was helping the Martinis move.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he cared about them. He probably didn't do that for every single person, but he knew everybody when they're doing the run on the bank. Oh, come on, so-and-so. He didn't have to be introduced. He knew all these people.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank Capra, though, and instead of doing what somebody might do today, or even back then, I guess, is go, I'm going to make Christian movies. What he did is he made really excellent stories that everyone could relate to that had that underpinning
right, yeah.
of his worldview and of what mattered. And that's why they still resonate today, because he fully did it in the way that he did more than just, I'll just, you know, make Christian movies.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an excellent point, because if it was a Christian movie, we probably wouldn't be talking about it right now. It would probably would have fell away like the rest of them. You know, there's just something about it when you set about telling a Christian story with that in mind, that doesn't work. It's hard to do that without feeling heavy-handed.
Well, yeah, and that's why, I mean, and it's funny because it doesn't matter what sort of direction you're trying to point something toward. And I'm thinking of I haven't seen Exodus. I don't know if you have.
No, I have not.
Okay, but I'm thinking of all the reviews that I've seen for it, which really surprised me, because what they're criticizing is there's a lack of heart to the movie, a lack of soul to the movie. These are words that regular movie critics are using who don't really care about faith one way or the other, maybe.
Mm.
But that's not what they're looking for. They're looking for a complete storytelling experience. And they know you can't have Exodus without God. And Ridley Scott spent so much time, I guess, taking out God from the miracles, and I don't know how else he did it. Mm-hmm. But you look at that versus the Charlton Heston, Yul Brynner version, and think, they weren't specifically going, and let's convert everyone. They were telling a fantastic story from an amazing story source that everyone knew.
Yes.
And embellishing it and telling and adding things in to make it more complete.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah, and even so in Noah, even in Noah, you know, God was present in Noah.
Oh my gosh.
Is that what they're telling you, that that Exodus, God is not present anywhere in it? Is that what you suspect,
I believe he's there, but because everything had a natural explanation as well as everything else, there's kind of a lack of this divine presence. I would have to read more reviews. I've kind of been collecting them and holding off because I eventually will see it, and I don't want to spoil my perception too much. But I was really surprised to see that on Rotten Tomatoes, it had, what, 28% of critics liked it?
That's rough.
And 40% of the general audience liked it. That may have changed by now. That was from
Ridley Scott has had a little bit of a rough run, though. I thought Prometheus was pretty difficult, too. I don't know if you saw that.
It was terrible. Yeah. Yes, I saw it. I'm trying to forget I saw it. But, well, you know, Rose made an interesting point. Since we're way off topic, I'll just keep going with Exodus for a minute. She said, you know, it's interesting to think about Exodus and the lack of maybe trust in using God in the story with his brother Tony Scott's suicide. And she said, I don't know if that really means anything, but that's part of his life, too.
Yeah.
Maybe he's angry. And of course, from there, you can go on to all kinds of speculation. But my main point in bringing it up was to say that anybody who narrows their focus too much to make sure that they're pounding that nail with that hammer, I don't care if you're religious or not religious, you're not doing the story a full service. Whereas Darren Aronofsky cared enough to explore everything in the story and let it go, whether it was what he agreed with or not necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, when you're constraining
it. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you're constraining it, you're just not doing the story service, and you're not doing your craft a service, your art a service. So we're lucky Frank Capra took that to heart and went, well, let me think more about what I'm doing. But he didn't stop and try to do a laser point show or something.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's an excellent point. Yeah, so doing something in the service of atheism, so probably any ism, is going to screw up your story if that's, you know, those things just kind of come to be in your storytelling naturally.
Yeah, because the only people then who appreciate it are the people who are in your echo chamber too. And is that the point of telling a story? Only to tell it to people who already know what you're saying? And I mean, I think there's more to telling a story than that.
Yeah, there certainly is.
You know?
Yeah.
I think of Bill Maher with Religulists or whatever it was called.
I never did watch that. Did you watch
that? Yeah, no, because he was telling it to one set of people and those people wanted to see it, but I wasn't one of those people. I was kind of actually curious when I first heard about it. And then I started seeing all the reviews and seeing what people said and went, oh, well, I could get this from, you know, atheist I know. I don't have to go see this guy doing it.
Yeah. You can pay money to go to the movie.
Yeah. I don't have to pay money for somebody to mock me. I can get that next door. There are people lining up to mock me. Come on.
Oh, no question. That's too funny. That is too funny.
Oh, did it strike you, speaking from a Catholic point of view, when George wasn't born, that it was like one aspect of purgatory?
It didn't affect me. I didn't think about that when I was watching it, but it's an interesting thought.
Well, just because I'd seen it so many times, we were going to talk about it, and I was looking at what kind of a nightmare scene it was. It's like everybody's worst dream that Rod Serling could have done it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, in one sense, it is a great gift. He does get to see how, as Clarence says, each man's life touches so many other lives. And I thought, well, you know, in purgatory, you're shown, well, you're kind of scrubbed clean, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, when we die, we are who we are. We don't suddenly become miraculously perfect. And so purgatory is the chance to kind of finish making up for, you know, fixing that window that you hit with your baseball, so to speak.
Right.
And yeah. I thought, well, you know, one of the ideas I'd read, it might have been Peter Kraft who said it, was that in a sense you're shown your whole life. See, and I always thought of it as just seeing where you went wrong, but I guess you also get to see where you went right. Why wouldn't okay. God do that for you? Why would he just go
ahead? So in my case, that would take 5 minutes to show the second part. And then the purgatory would take quite a lot longer.
Well, if we give it, it's what, a wonderful 40, life.
40-something years worth of that. So now I understand purgatory completely.
Right.
No!
I think you did wonderful things, whether you believed or not. So
just you betcha. You
every
betcha.
Time a bell rings, an angel visits me. So just stop it, Scott.
Every time a bell rings, Scott gets an hour off of purgatory. That's
right. Purgatory, let's start ringing those bells. I'm older. I need more time.
Oh, my gosh.
But it just did strike me. I suddenly thought, oh, we're seeing, you know, we see what the effect he had just – we see his flaws and everything in the beginning part. And in the last part, of course, it's that hellish nightmare of Pottersville and nobody knows him and everybody's worse off. Mm. And I just thought, oh, I guess you would see the good part about your life too.
Yeah. And then at the end is the tearful man. That gets me too. I mean, it's an emotional movie for me.
Yeah.
But the end when all the people start to come and thank him for everything that he's done for them.
I know.
Just great.
Well, and even the people who he hasn't done anything for, like Annie, their black maid, who she's so funny. And she's like, this is the money I was saving to divorce somebody if I ever get married.
Oh, too good.
Yeah, so it's just because it's somebody in need. And, of course, he is a good guy, and they all do love him. But it's that community thing again.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it by yourself. He needs Mary, and he needs those other people, but they all need him too.
Right, right. And that's the wonderful thing.
Yeah.
That is the wonderful thing, yeah.
Exactly.
If you have friends. How did that go again? Something about friends.
About each man's life touching others, or
yeah, it was like, you know, you can get by if you have friends. It's not a Beatles song. The Beatles song came after.
I can get by with a little help from my friends. Right, that's exactly. The Beatles song.
There you go. Yeah, but no, every man is rich who has friends, or something.
Oh that's right. Exactly. Right. It was in the movie.
It was in this movie we're talking about.
There were a lot of statements like that in this movie that were kind of summing up for you quickly. So
You bet.
And he was right. Clarence was right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, something that my husband and I were talking about the next morning, we were taking a walk with our dogs, and my husband suddenly started thinking about Mr. Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, why was he crippled? Not why in this, why would, you know, what part of his story made him crippled, but just like, why was he in a wheelchair? Why was that important? And the first thing he said was, when was this made? It was after the Depression. It was after World War II. And I went, what? And he goes, I know. I'm thinking of Roosevelt.
How about that?
And
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah. And I thought, oh my gosh, if somebody didn't approve of the New Deal and more government regulations and all that sort of thing. And we had no idea.
Yeah. So that's interesting because here on this Wikipedia page that I read a while back, it talks about his politics.
Mm-hmm.
Let me find this right here. Political beliefs. There's just a paragraph. It says, Capra's political beliefs coalesced in his films, which promoted and celebrated the spirit of American individualism. A conservative Republican... He had railed against Franklin Delano Roosevelt during his tenure as governor of New York State and opposed his presidency during the years of the Depression. Capra stood against government intervention and assistance during the national economic crisis. A man that had come up the hard way, overcoming the disadvantages of an immigrant background, Capra saw no reason why others could not accomplish success through hard work and perseverance.
Hmm.
Huh.
Well, and I remember that just recently, isn't it, that this spate of articles or books has started coming out going, you know, everybody thought the New Deal was really what you had to do to get out of the Depression. But now that they're looking back with the advantage of hindsight, they're starting to say that might not have been the best thing. It might have made the Depression longer.
Hmm.
And I don't know. I haven't looked into it. But now that you say that, I'm thinking, oh, well, I guess that would have been the point of view of people like Frank Capra.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so he was, let's see, I'm just trying to think of his actions during the movie, Potter's actions, his economic actions, that is,
yeah.
the way that he was dealing with money. I mean, he certainly wasn't giving any money to anybody for not working, right?
Well, he was as long as he got an advantage from them. But and, you know, and the fact that my husband thought of this, he was just kind of letting his mind range because we didn't know any of that stuff that you said, which I'm going to tell him he's going to be very interested.
That's cool.
But the thing that we did start thinking about is, you know, you make a movie like this, you, as we've discussed, you do not put in a lot of symbols without them meaning something to you usually at some level. And so we thought, well, the really obvious thing is Mr. Potter's crippled because he's crippled in his soul. Mm-hmm. It's like his heart's legs are broken. I mean, you know, he's not nice. He doesn't like anyone. He doesn't have any friends. He doesn't do anything for anybody else
ever. His heart is several sizes too small.
Yeah. He's a Grinch.
Name that. Yeah, that's right. The Grinch.
He would go out of his way to take everyone's Christmas presents.
Yeah.
Anything, Max, help him.
But you're right. Yeah, that's the answer I probably would have given.
Yeah.
But that's very interesting.
Then I thought, well, you know, that's really interesting because George, from an early age, is deaf in one ear. Mm-hmm. He only hears half of the truth. Think how long it takes for Clarence to get him to understand what's going on. Think how many times he has to be told again and again because he's, as you say, he's got his mind so much on what he wants already.
Yeah.
So
he's deaf in one ear, so he's not hearing it all.
Yeah, he's only hearing half the truth.
Wow. I like that. Yep.
And then, and I mean, because it's really obvious when, you know, and this is really, you know, because it's a visual art, so it's not like it's a big deal. But of course, the real difference between Pottersville, you don't have to go into any of those buildings. He doesn't even have to walk by them. All he has to do is walk to the beginning of downtown, and it just hits you how tawdry and low it is. And different. Although, as my husband said, he goes, wow, it's a swinging place. Like, bars and jazz joints are no good for anyone, I guess. So, but then when it goes back to Bedford Falls, I don't know about you, but I just kind of relaxed and went, oh, good. That's a place where you can be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there's that real obvious symbolism. They use it because it's a quick way to telegraph. And that's what made us think, oh, well, this other stuff isn't out of line to think about. And then think about that house they live in. It gets fixed up. You know, they're married. She's fixing it up. Their family is growing. So it's them flourishing together. And when he hasn't been there, and so they never got married or anything. That's like the state of his heart, or the state of everybody's hearts would have been. And it's like the heart of the town.
Wow.
It's just a crumbled ruin.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating. Yep.
So.
That's cool.
I can read into other things if you'd like.
just read away. I love it.
But we really kind of got into that, just going, wow, look at all that's there if you just look at it this way.
Yeah, yeah, that's neat.
It's all kind of just reinforcing everything.
Yeah, and again, you wonder, you know, what was purposeful and what just comes out, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
But it is the thing of probably not the Roosevelt part, but it is the thing of once the artist's piece of work is out there, it's there for people to see what they see in it.
Right. Yep, it's a two-way street. It's the movie's no good without watchers.
Yeah, it's a collaborative effort,
exactly,
I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Books even more so.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Because that's in your head.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. Because there needs to be jazz joints in heaven, so
Oh, Louis Armstrong has to be there.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah.
Art Tatum, I need my piano playing. Come on.
I love it. I love that.
Yep.
So cool. So are there any other holiday movies that you enjoy? Is there anything that you watch every single year?
Well, you know, The Grinch.
Yeah, yeah.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
The Grinch, I'm assuming the animated one.
Oh, my gosh. I'd managed to forget there was another one, but now I'll just take that as a penance. Also, I really like The Santa Claus.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
What about you?
I've seen that. There's one, the ones that really make me feel Christmassy just immediately upon seeing them are those claymation Rudolph and all that, because I grew up watching those.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Brown Christmas.
Yeah.
Those are just, you know, nostalgia for me. You watch those and you remember a very good childhood with Christmases.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was nice. And there's a new one out that I just love and my kids love. That came out maybe 5 years ago, maybe a little bit less, from, I'm pretty sure it was Lasseter and the Pixar people. It's called Prep and Landing. Have you seen that? It's a half an hour show.
Prep?
P-R-E-P.
Okay. Oh, so it's like landing. Santa. Okay.
Yeah, it's about these elves that prep the site for, yeah. So it came out in 2009.
I can't believe we didn't hear of it if it's Pixar, because we love that stuff.
But it's just a little half hour show. Yeah. And I'm just wondering here who directed it here. Yeah, I don't see Lasseter's name on it. Full cast and crew. Well, I don't see Lasseter's name on it, but it is a Disney, and that's right around where he, you know. Oh, there it is. Executive producer.
Okay, I was going to say Disney's allowed to have good stuff too. So without him,
that's but I just, you know, because I said he was in there, so he was executive producer, which I'm not sure what that means, but he was present in some meetings apparently.
Yes, he didn't stop it.
Exactly. But it's fun. It is a really fun show.
It's
about these two elves. And one of them's been at it a long time. The other one's brand new.
Okay. I'm already there.
Good this deal. Good deal. And there's actually a sequel that's not as good. It's called Prep and Landing Naughty and Nice.
Okay.
But
we'll avoid that one.
You don't need to avoid it. It's just not as good. No. Still good.
Well, you know, my husband has never seen A Christmas Story, and so I'm determined this year to. I know.
It's like it's on 24 hours in a row on TNT.
That's what I thought, but I've got to find it and get him to watch it.
That's great.
I know, because I think
That's a movie that I just love too. Little Orphan Annie.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, with that decoder ring, and he gets it done, and it's like. It's an advertiser. What did he call it?
Yeah.
It's a commercial. That's what he said.
Yeah.
Oh, that made me laugh out loud. I just like
leg lamp.
Yep, the leg lamp was great. That's, Major award.
You'll shoot your eye out with that. You can't have, it's all that stuff that you learned as a kid, and it's set a little older than my own childhood, but it's close enough that I can kind of relate to it a little, and just in having seen TV shows with that kind of stuff on it.
I can sure relate to it as well. I have no problem relating to that.
And,
you know, there's a lot
I did want to say one thing about, I know everybody knows this already, but I feel like we need to just set one thing straight that, you know, that thing about you should never get your theology from Hollywood and TV. Mm-hmm. And so the whole idea about, you know, Clarence died 200 years ago and he still isn't an angel. He doesn't have his wings. That's not right.
Yeah.
By the way, angels are separate.
Yep.
They're pure spirit. They were created.
They're not people.
Yeah, they're
created. I mean, they're not humans. Let me put that.
Yeah, they're their own persons. They are persons.
Right.
But they're not people. I mean, they're not human beings.
Exactly as you say.
So
they didn't used to be human beings.
They didn't. And in fact, I never thought about angels before, you know, I became Catholic anyway, but then recently my hairdresser had said something about, well, you know, when my mother died, they said, well, you know, God wanted another angel. And that made me so mad at God. And I'm like, okay, There are a whole lot of things wrong with this, and I'll talk to you about all of them because you just started cutting my hair.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh.
And it was a good conversation, but one of them was, I was like, you know, your mom isn't an angel. Well, yeah. And I went, no, she's not, and let me explain it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, I never knew that. Okay. So I just thought I'd bring that up.
Well, that's a good thing to bring up. It's a good thing to bring up. Well,
you know.
Yeah, I like reading books about angels. There actually aren't that many of them. We don't know a heck of a lot, do we?
Well, we know some. I do have several books about angels.
Cool. If you have a good one, I'd love to hear about it.
Well, actually, you know, one of the best ones is Peter Kreef's Questions and Answer book about angels.
I have it, and I've read that one. I liked it a lot.
Mike Aquilina wrote a really good one called Angels of God.
Oh, okay. I need to write that one down.
It's fairly new. A year or two ago?
Didn't Mike Aquilina write A Year with the Angels?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have that one, too.
Yeah, but that's different. That's like church fathers or saints quoting about things about angels.
Mm-hmm.
The Angels of God one is talking, it's explaining angels and everything. And
oh, fantastic.
The interesting thing is, well, I like his writing style anyway, but mm-hmm. he comes at it from, of course, a different point of view because he's explaining it and not doing a question and answer thing. So it just has different information and told to you differently. So it's good.
Cool.
Just FYI.
Yes. Very much want to read that one. So,
yeah.
So. On my list. Yep. And there it is. Yep.
Okay.
Available on the Kindle.
Hey, hey.
And also, yep, not Kindle. And there's,
mm-hmm.
oh, that's interesting. It says Audible Audio Edition, unabridged, $0.
What? Oh, that's if you sign up with Audible, because they don't know.
Oh, they're saying, oh, if you sign up, you get it for free.
Yeah, they're trying to lure you into signing up with Audible. But hold on. There's one other one that I want to tell you about that it's a little different. It's called Angels. It's by Jane Williams.
Okay.
And she is British. She's a theologian. But she's written a couple of books that I really like that have a lot of art in them.
Okay.
And so this book talks about angels, but it also has all these different paintings of angels in different scenes. Yeah. So it's kind of more like it's informative, but it could almost be used like a devotional too, in a way, I feel.
Okay. Nice.
Really liked it. So those are all nice complimentary books about angels. Since it's Christmas, we might as well talk about that.
Right. There's some angels at Christmas time.
Yeah.
There's people, a whole bunch of people out there abiding, doing nothing but abiding. And then, boom, out comes an angel.
Yeah.
Orchestra, scares the crap symphony, out of them.
Big song, yeah.
And he's like, what are you guys doing? And they say, abiding. That's all I'm doing.
Me and my sheep. We're out here abiding.
Yeah.
Why? What's it to you?
Exactly. That's exactly what they said.
I'm pretty sure they had that attitude. Well, in fact, I think it was the Jane Williams book that pointed out that, you know what, we think of it, oh, these luminous angels, because they talk about there was a great light. And it said, think about the effect it would have had on these shepherds. They'd never seen an electric light. There was no such thing. And I went, oh, my goodness, that changed my whole impression of the whole scene.
Oh, that's great.
Which is why it's always fun to read those kinds of books where you think, it's so basic. I know this stuff, but there's always some nugget or some other way of looking at things that just opens things up a little bit more.
Heck yeah, that's neat. Very nice, very nice.
Thank you so much for choosing this movie,
well,
Scott.
Well, thank you for watching it. Yeah, it certainly is one of my, you know, I was racking my brain trying to come up with something that was like rare. And I was just like, darn it, you know, this is just a great movie.
Yeah.
But it's so fun to talk about. Yeah. I just love it. I love so many things about it.
Mm-hmm.
It really is near perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
A little less Buffalo Gals is all you all I'm saying. I told that to my husband. He goes, you and Rose, everything's too long for you. You always want to trim a scene here or there.
Oh, shoot. I love that.
So I think he feels like you do.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Well, this is the close of year number 4, isn't it? Can you imagine? That's just incredible.
It doesn't seem like that long.
It doesn't. It's flown by.
I still love it so much.
And I do. I really enjoy every minute. So thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you. This was your idea in the first place.
You bet. Well, It was fun. Couldn't do it without you.
Oh, likewise, I'm sure.
You bet. And you folks who are listening, too.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Just
Merry Christmas to all of you, and thanks so much for listening. Really appreciate it. We love hearing from you, so
yeah,
contact us in one of a number of ways if you can.
Yeah, leave a comment at the blog.
Mm-hmm.
Leave us a review on iTunes. Yeah. Send us an email. Our emails are in the sidebar at the blog.
They are, you bet. Yeah. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, and there's some people who have become regular commenters. I just can't tell you how much I love it after an episode goes up. Sometimes within an hour, somebody has commented, and I'm like, oh my gosh, they got it and listened and it came right back to talk.
That makes me happy.
Exciting.
It does. It does. Yeah. And all so thoughtful, too. I learned from all of them.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so worthwhile to read the comments.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Which is not the case in most places on the internet, I must say.
No.
But I just love it. Yeah, so so please come say hi or say hi in an email or whatever. But even if you don't, Merry Christmas. Thank you very, very much. And your life is very meaningful, says Frank Capra, and God.
and us.
And us. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Yes.
See you in January.
Okay, so we're not going to talk about.
Yeah, we should probably tell.
They could read next.
Oh, we better, shouldn't we?
I mean, that's okay.
You can let's do it. Let's do it. You know, that was the emotional wave.
I know it was an emotional wave, and I went, "Oh my gosh, I can't stop it because it's perfect." But
that's all right.
If anybody wants to read ahead,
that's right. So
gonna be in trouble.
All right, what we're gonna have? We'll be back on January the 14th. With Everything That Rises Must Converge by our patron saint, Flannery O'Connor.
Yes.
Yes, we know she's not really a saint, but she is
our
patron.
She's probably in heaven.
Yeah.
That's a saint.
Probably so.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. So another collection of very rough stories to start the year.
Thank goodness we just watched a really nice movie.
That's right.
It'll help hold us over.
And then after that, we have our 100th episode, and there's going to be something a little special there. But the book we're going to talk about with a mystery guest is Among Others by Joe Walton. And our guest selected that book.
Yes.
So
and that book won the Nebula, 2011 Nebula, and 2012 Hugo, I think.
Yeah,
is that how the years work? I looked it up anyway.
Okay.
It won the Nebula and the Hugo. It was
cool.
It was a much beloved book.
Much beloved. Yes.
Or much honored book.
Much beloved, much book. Welshness. Welshy science fiction mentioning book.
Yes, and if you enjoy audiobooks, I have to say this is really a terrific audiobook. I've been listening to it. So,
okay, cool. That's the way I'll do it too. So wonderful. Okay, so now we'll see you next time. All right. Take care, everybody.
We've had too much eggnog. What can we say, people? It's just...
Yeah, did I mention that I drink constantly during this podcast? I don't know if that affects anyone's opinion, but...
The way he keeps throwing the bourbon into his eggnog cup, I can't believe he could even talk at all. But me, it's the champagne.
That's right. And a happy new year to everybody. See you in 2015.
Yes, 2015 or bust.
Or bust.
Have a great Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Yes. All right. See you later, everybody. Bye-bye.